Does government outrank biology over the question of gender? That's really what's at stake in this dreary but national drama over who can use public restrooms in North Carolina. North Carolina's controversial bathroom bill, formerly known as HB2, is the subject of a lawsuit against the federal government. North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory was told by DOJ last week to give up the law, but instead, he filed a lawsuit declaring,
"I do not agree with their interpretation of federal law."
North Carolina says that transgender citizens must use bathrooms corresponding to the gender on their birth certificates, even if it's different from the gender with which they now identify. But for U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, this amounts to suppressing the rights of a whole class of citizens.
What this law does is inflict further indignity on a population that has already suffered far more than its fair share. This law provides no benefit to society, and all it does is harm innocent Americans.
Billions of dollars in education funding is at stake for North Carolina, but Governor McCrory is standing on principle. Why do gender-segregated bathrooms have a place in the history of U.S. civil rights? Terry Kogan, a University of Utah law professor and author of Sex Separation in Public Restrooms, Law, Architecture, and Gender, says that the United States began applying moral principles to restroom architecture more than a century ago.
The origin of laws requiring sex separation in public restrooms can be traced back to the beginning of the 19th century and a strong cultural ideology that pervaded American society that has often been called by historians a separate sphere ideology. The idea was that women should remain in the home, that women's role was to rear children, to tend the hearth fires, and men's role was to go out into the public realm, politicians, to go into factories. This ideology remained part of American culture throughout the 19th century. The problem was that by early in the century, the realities of 19th century economy belied the ideology. Women were present in factories in large numbers, in textile factories in the Northeast by the 1920s. What ended up happening is over the course of the century, as women became more and more present in the public, American regulators began figuring out ways of trying to, in effect, protect women in the public since they could not be forced back into the home. So you find a range of architectural solutions, all of which was, in a way, an attempt to create a private haven, a protective space for women in the public realm.
It's almost as though there's this, you know, bit of Sharia law being enforced that comes from a long, long time ago. And America was described in the 1800s as being more Victorian even than the Brits with its Puritan background. Why is this so difficult to let go of for North Carolina?
The hidden culprit is the rise of the Uniform Building Code movement, a movement that began in the 1920s. A movement aimed at various building officials, engineers, architects, contractors, building material dealers, coming together and trying to adopt a code that could be enacted hook, line, and sinker by cities around the country that would ensure adequate public safety, health, and welfare in new construction. And hidden in the midst of the first Uniform Building Code in 1927 is a provision that says where there are public restrooms in buildings, they shall be separated by sex. Obviously, a law, a provision having little to do with public safety, but one which, in effect, carries forward this early 19th century separate spheres ideology into the beginning of the 20th century, and then what happens is every 10 or 15 years when the Uniform Code was updated by these building professionals, this provision related to sex separation sat there. No one touched it.
Is the very loose notion of gender or flexible notion of gender that we see now that embraces a whole community of transgender citizens. Is that consistent with anything that's going on here? It seems that North Carolina is just deciding on its own to reverse course on the question of gender, which has evolved beyond these laws. And the Department of Justice says it's discrimination. Do they have a point?
They definitely have a point. There is, has emerged, evolved over the last 15, 20 years, an understanding that human biology, human sexuality is not binary, that though biology is part of what it means to be a sexual, gendered human being, the sense of oneself, one's brain chemistry, is a critical part also of who we are as people. And there's a realization that, in fact, there is a rich tapestry of human gender out there, and that it's critical that our society come to grips with this and figure out how to create safe, accessible public restrooms for all people. I mean, it is amazing if you think about it that there is a group of people in our society, a significant group of people, transgender people, who do not feel safe in public places, walking into a restroom for fear of being attacked, for fear of being harassed, for fear of being yelled at. And it is high time that we as a society come to grips with the basic, decent human need that all people have to have safe public restrooms in America.
Terry Kogan is a University of Utah law professor and author of Sex Separation in Public Restrooms, Law, Architecture, and Gender. Thanks so much, Professor.
It's a pleasure, John.
Plenty of people around the country disagree with Professor Kogan. Should public restrooms be separated? Alina Dakin tweeted us, "I'd prefer separate, but I'm 100% on board with anyone female identifying joining me in the women's bathroom." Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Organic Valley, a co-op of family farms committed to the craft of organic farming. Founded in 1988, Organic Valley believes in producing food in a way that respects the earth, animals, and future generations.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.